Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. Who were the first Americans and where did they come from? Some scientists think that a 9,500-year-old skeleton that was found in Washington State back in 1996 might help answer those questions. It was found near Kennewick, Washington, and so came to be called Kennewick Man. It was one of the oldest skeletons ever found in North America. But virtually from the time that it was found, Kennewick Man has been the center of controversy. Native American tribes in the area laid claim to the remains under something called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, arguing that this was one of their ancestors and he should not be studied, he should be reburied. The government agreed. However, some scientists argued that a great deal of knowledge would be lost if they did not have at least some opportunity to study these remains. And so they went to court. And now, almost 5 years later, the fate of Kennewick Man is still unresolved. We'll be talking this morning about all of this with James Chatters. He's written a book entitled Ancient Encounters, Kennewick Man and the First Americans. He is an archaeologist and also paleoecologist. He's founder of Applied Paleoscience, a firm that specializes in forensic and archaeological consulting. He also is the deputy coroner for Benton County, Washington, which is how he became involved with Kennewick Man and actually had the opportunity as one of the few people who had the opportunity to see and look at these remains. He's also currently an adjunct associate professor of research at Central Washington University. And the book that we mentioned, Ancient Encounters, published by Simon & Schuster, it's out now. And we'll be talking about this tangled story this morning with James Chatters. And as we do, questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Chatters, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Sure, I'm glad to be here.
Kennewick Man was found by a couple of college students quite by accident. They found these bones, and of course, because there was, I guess, the possibility that this could be a crime, the coroner was notified, and you went along, and that was how it is you first happened to set eyes on Kennewick Man.
All right, pretty much. I was called in because I do the bone identifications for the coroner. That's my role there, is if bones are found, are they human? If they're human, who are they? When did they die?
Mm-hmm. So forth. And the was it your initial thought, or at what point did you come to feel that, before you really knew a great deal about it, that in fact this was not this person was not recently deceased, but probably had been there at least for a while?
Well, after the couple of days, I'd been cleaning the skeleton up, and I found a gray object embedded in the pelvis, actually healed inside the pelvis. And after x-rays and CAT scans, was able to see that it was a stone spear point embedded inside. And that spear point has a long time span, not only in North America, but other parts of the world. And so it didn't clear up who he was and where he was from, but it certainly raised the question of whether he was ancient, extremely ancient, or modern.
Mm.
So we ran a radiocarbon date on him, and about a month after the bones had been found, learned that he was roughly 9,500 years old.
Hmm. So apparently when the word got out about this find, and I guess this was actually before you had done the radiocarbon date, one of the tribes, or maybe more than one of the tribes, particularly one, though, that lived and sort of had claim to this place where the skeleton was found, came forward and said, as has been said before, they said, look, this is one of our people, and what we should do here is immediately rebury him. And they went to the Army Corps of Engineers. This area was under their jurisdiction, and made that claim. And the Corps said, well, yeah, that seems to be the case. And so the bones, they came to you and took the bones away from you, and that was the last you saw Kennewick Man.
Well, pretty much. the Umatilla tribe, which is the one you're talking about, was already making claims on the bones the day after they were found, simply because they came from the river, they had to be theirs. And we were insisted on completing our investigation because it wasn't immediately clear that that was the case. And it still is, of course, not clear that that's the case. But the land that the bones were found on is owned in fee title by the Corps of Engineers. So they have jurisdiction, and it's covered by federal law. So once we had the radiocarbon date back, and then the tribal claims became rather strident, and Cork stepped in 4 days later and took control of the bones. Since that time, I've actually seen the bones once. I was, Doug Owsley, the Smithsonian, and I went in and inventoried the skeleton before it was moved from one holding location to another. But that was what is now 3 years ago.
Yeah. And Owsley is one of the people who is a party to this. You're not a party to this lawsuit, but he is one of those.
Right. I'm not a party to the lawsuit because I had some opportunity to study, and the lawsuit is over the right to study, so that would tend to confuse the issue somewhat.
So was it when you got the radiocarbon date and it said that that Kennewick Man was more than 9,000 years old, were you surprised?
Well, that was one of the possibilities, but yes, I was quite surprised. I'd never expected it to be not only in the older range of possibilities, but outside the older range in the old direction. I thought it might be between 5,000 and 9,000 years old, because that spear point style is fairly common at that time period in the Northwest. But when it came out 500 years older, that was a significant surprise.
But apparently it was also one of the confusing, interesting, perplexing things also about Kennewick Man was that when you took a look at the skeleton, it was apparently fairly obvious that he didn't look like the native people who live in the Northwest now.
Right. Take one look at him, and it's like, oh, well, you're not from around here, are you? Well, perhaps he was, but not recently. He's very different. We conduct comparisons between Kennewick Man and other ancient Americans and all modern peoples, and found that they don't resemble modern folks, period. They're really very different. Mm-hmm. And some of the people they're the farthest from in their characteristics are modern American Indians.
And I know one of the things that you did, and perhaps people have seen some reconstructions of like this, that you can take a skull and you, based upon certain points of the skull, then you can determine what the musculature that overlaid that would look like. And then you can determine what, from there, you can actually make a person and apparently get a reasonable approximation of what the person looked like if you have their skull.
Right. The bone structure underneath our faces dictates to a very great extent what our faces look like. It's the primary controlling factor. And if a person doesn't carry a great deal of extra weight, you can get a very close rendition of what the human being looks like. There are some folks who are good at it, some folks aren't, but some of the people who are skilled at this can actually produce an individual who, they'll take a modern skull, they'll make a model of a skull of a living person using a CAT scan, and then produce a skull from that, put a face on it, and tell the facial reconstruction artist, okay, reconstruct this face, please. You produce it, come compare it to the living individual, and it can be extremely close. So our muscles are attached to bones. The muscles are the underlying structure of the face. You put a little tissue over the top, and there you are.
So based upon that reconstruction, if we went looking for somebody who would look like Kennewick Man, where might we find that person?
Well, we'd have a hard time finding anyone who really looked that much like him, but the people who most closely resemble Kennewick Man and the other earliest Americans are Polynesian and the Ainu people of Japan. The Ainu are folks that occupied Japan before the expansion of Korean farmers into the southern Japanese islands about 2,300 years ago. And they're extremely different in their physical appearance from Japanese. You would not imagine that that's where they were from if you saw them walking down the street.
So how important, when it became obvious that Kennewick Man was as old as he was, and based on his physical characteristics, the fact that there were a lot of interesting questions about, well, who exactly this man was and where did he come from? How did he end up being where he was? How important a find was this?
Well, it's extremely important. He's should be looked on as a national treasure. We have two individuals older than 9,000 years ago in North America whose skeletons are nearly complete, Kennewick Man and a mummy from a cave in Nevada known as Spirit Cave. That's the only folks we have from the earliest times, and they're not even the earliest times, and they're probably a good 6,000 years removed from the first arrivals, but they're the closest we're going to get. And each one of those skeletons tells us not only what the earliest people looked like, what their body morphology was, but it also gives us a real intimate peek into the nature of their lives. And that's the only way we have of getting that peek, is by looking at people's skeletons. Their artifacts, the tools that they make, the foods that they ate, give us some indication of the nature of their lives, but they don't really tell us what it was like to be them.
Maybe I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with James Chatters. He is an archaeologist and also paleoecologist. He's a founder of Applied Paleoscience, which is a firm that specializes in forensic and archaeological consulting. He's also adjunct associate professor of research at Central Washington University, and he's the deputy coroner for Benton County, Washington. And he's written a book that we're talking about. The book is titled Ancient Encounters, Kennewick Man and the First Americans, published by Simon and Schuster. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's talk about the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, because that seems to be a central question here, what it is and the intent. And as you say, almost immediately when Kennewick Man was found, one tribe in particular said that this is on the land that traditionally we've been. So we're saying that this is one of our forebears, and that they make this argument that Native Americans have been making for some time now, and that's why we have this law saying that, you know, the graves of their ancestors had been routinely desecrated, and that what should be done with remains like this is that they immediately should be reburied. And so they make this argument that says, you know, you wouldn't like it much if we went to the cemetery and dug up your great-grandparents and put them on display. Well, we think that that's what's happened to our ancestors, and they're in museums and they're in university anthropology departments and they're on display, and that's wrong. So that this stuff ought to be, if it can be established that people now today are related to them, then those remains ought to be returned to them, and then they, you know, treat them in keeping with their culture and rebury them. So that's essentially the argument. I think you, though, and the scientists who are involved in this lawsuit say, well, Kennewick Man is a special case, that the Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act wasn't intended to apply to something like this.
Right. Well, that's what the congressmen have told us.
How do we weigh these arguments, in particular the one made by Native Americans that say, look, you know, this, we shouldn't be messing around with this stuff. It shouldn't be studied. We should treat them with respect, and it should go back into the ground.
Well, there are a lot of ways of treating people with respect. And when they're, now, NAGPRA is a well-intentioned law, and it's a law of a sort that we actually need to have on the books, because graves were being desecrated and still are occasionally in some places. And that's certainly wrong to be going about that. But NAGPRA was intended to apply to recent skeletal material that was from known cemeteries, and actually its main impetus was to return the skeletons of known individuals, actually named individuals, to their families. Mm. There were some practices in the 19th century conducted mainly by the U.S. Army that were not particularly, aren't considered particularly moral in our present-day society. In the 19th century society, they were probably a little questionable even then. But these claims that any skeleton from the Americas is automatically subject to claim by one modern American Indian group or another is not what the law was intended for. And what it does, what that misuse of the law does, is it denies us the opportunity to learn who the first Americans actually were. And it denies future generations of kids who are of American Indian descent deprives them of knowing the full nature of who was in this continent, or even knowing something about what their ancestors' lives were like. Now, we hear the claims a lot from the Indian activists that well, if you archaeologists want to know what life was like in the past, why don't you just ask the elders? Well, you have to remember the elders are in their 50s and 60s, and this is now 2001. They were born in the 1940s. They didn't live by the old ways. They don't really know what the old ways were because they didn't participate in them. And cultures change through time rather rapidly. And consequently, the folks who were alive beginning in 1940 have no understanding of what life was like even 1,500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, even less time than that. So what NAGPRA was intended to do was to reunite people with their families, give tribes control over the cemeteries that were clearly theirs. It was not intended for this purpose at all.
And apparently, when one approaches this, if someone would come forth and they would make claim to some particular remains, you would start by trying to establish some sort of actual familial relationship.
Yes,
and if you can't have that, then you would say, well, then you would need to establish some sort of cultural tie. And if you can't establish that, it seems that the default position is that, well, if this was found on land that traditionally has been where your people have lived, that's apparently, in the eyes of the law, good enough to make a claim.
Right, and they're saying it regardless of how old it is.
Yeah.
It's like, it's like modern Europeans laying claim to anybody who was in Spain, for example, any time in the past, like maybe 600,000 years ago or so. Well, actually, we're not quite that old there yet, but there are human remains there, or humanoid remains there that are 200,000 years old. No one is claiming them as a direct ancestor. Nobody is making a religious claim that they should bury those remains. We do see a similar thing going on, however, in Israel, where the fundamentalist sects there, the ultra-Orthodox, protest any time human skeletons are found and are being excavated, even if those skeletons are Neanderthals, who we don't even know to be the same species as we are. So when you make a claim on the basis of geography, you're denying the existence of historical processes that have been underway ever since that person died. And one of those historical processes is folks move around a great deal.
One of the tests of that you wanted to do, or early on when the carbon dating was done, was to do a DNA test.
Right.
And there is a way that you can test for a particular kind of DNA, mitochondrial DNA, that would actually tell you if there are living descendants of Kennewick Man, and would tell you who they are, and this would give you, that would definitely say, is there somebody who has a familial tie, and would tell you where it was this man had come from, or perhaps at least give you a pretty good idea. And
yeah,
that
actually, it doesn't work quite that way.
Well, okay. Maybe
mitochondrial DNA is passed from female to child.
Yes.
Kennewick Man being a male wouldn't pass his mitochondrial DNA on to anybody. But what it does, mitochondrial DNA is found in the small organelles, or little basically energy processing structures in our cells. And it has its own inheritance process and is passed along in the cytoplasm of the egg. And when, because it's so abundant, there are many, many mitochondria in each cell, so there's a tremendous amount of mitochondrial DNA, and the chance of it surviving in bone is fairly good as long as the bone isn't undergoing some horrible chemical processes. And it's possible to extract some of that mitochondrial DNA, multiply it, and then determine what group it belongs to. And that doesn't mean what tribe, it means what female lineage it belongs to. And the female lineages go back to the old world. So it's possible to see what lineage he might belong to. And if we're dealing with a modern person, we can tie him to, is he likely to be American Indian? Is he likely to be European? Is he likely to be African? Because they have very different mitochondrial patterns in those three populations. But it's not possible to take an ancient person and determine who he's related to now.
Oh, okay. Well, in any case, that test was never done.
No, the attempts were made later, but they didn't use bone that was really suitable for the process. The best material for extracting DNA is teeth, because the dentine in the teeth is extremely dense and can protect the DNA from destruction. They allowed the DNA experts to work with fragments of ribs and bits of hand bone, and they're really quite thin, and the chance of the DNA surviving there is pretty slim, especially over 9,500 years. When I had the skeleton in my hands, I didn't treat nor x-ray two of the teeth so that they would be available for study at a later time. And unfortunately, they didn't allow them to use those for reasons that I don't understand. Mm.
Well, that would though, have provided, again, part of the answer of where...
It would certainly narrow things down. Yeah. And it would say whether or not American Indians and this population, or this individual's population, came from the same genetic root. Mm-hmm. Did they descend from the same subpopulation of humanity? That's about as narrow as it could go, simply in part because, as I said again, Kenwick Man didn't have mitochondrial DNA descendants.
Yeah. Well, then, if you had that bit of information, would that settle the discussion about who should have control over his remains, or would that would the same argument be going on?
Yeah, it wouldn't solve it. No, it would it would add to our knowledge about the earliest people in America, but it would not solve the question of relationship. And really, the question of relationship, from the scientific point of view, is moot. There's so much time between the death of this man and the lives of the people who are now making claim to him that at most they might share, let's see, 1 over 2 to the 450th power of the genetic material with him. Hmm. That's not very much time. That's not very much shared heritage. Not enough, certainly, to make a claim of ownership. 2 to the 200 to 450th power, by the way, is way up there in the tens of billions. So it's not a very extensive relationship to be talking about.
This court case now has been going on for, about four years, maybe?
Five years. Yeah, 5 years coming up this October.
So why is it that this has taken so long to be resolved?
Well, in part, the government dragged their feet. That was a big piece of it. They said, well, you know, we're not going to let you guys study. Or they made first claim was, well, these individuals don't have standing to make a claim under this law. And it took about 6 months to get that resolved. And then it was, well, we don't know enough to make a decision here. The judge says, you have to go back and study this. You didn't make the decision properly. You have to go back and revisit this and really actually analyze the evidence to determine if Kenwick Man is related to these modern people. And so they took 3 years to do that. And it's just been one delaying action after another on the part of the government.
So do you expect that then sometime soon, over the next few months maybe, that this there finally will be a decision?
Well, any day now we're supposed to hear from the judge with his final decision on the case.
And how long has it been any day now you're expecting to hear something?
Well, the case was heard in court the 19th and 20th of June. So we're just 2 months down the line here, and we knew it would be a while. He told us it would be a while because the case is so complex, and it's a landmark case as far as this law is concerned. So this judge doesn't want to make a snap decision that's going to be overturned on appeal. He wants to look at all the evidence, make sure he's covered every base that could possibly be covered before he puts this thing out. And he's really a very good judge. He's really astute.
Another wrinkle came up in this case early in August when someone else weighed in on this. This was someone who was of Samoan descent who said, "Well, now Kennewick Man is he's Polynesian, so he's part of my people. So we think the remains should be turned over to us." And apparently, what they said that they would do, or what this man said they would do, he would allow some limited testing, and then the remains would go to a museum, and I guess later on would be buried in American Samoa.
Yeah, this is a fellow who had previously put forward the theory that Polynesians came from South America, and the fact that the earliest Americans somewhat resemble, not very much, by the way, but they somewhat resemble Polynesians, and certainly more like Polynesians than anyone else, that supported his theory. So he's then reversing and making the claim that since Kenwick Man is Polynesian-like, therefore. That proves his point, and he must be an ancestor. It's been an extremely interesting case from that point of view, that it's brought out so many rather unusual points of view. But it's also been an extremely difficult thing to be part of. When the skeleton turned up, and I thought it was because his physical characteristics weren't like American Indians, and it looked like he was a fairly recent individual. I thought, oh, good, I'm going to have a chance to study this one for a while because there aren't going to be any claims on him. We'll get to learn about him. He'll probably be Mr. Early Kennewick Pioneer and be somebody discussed in the lore of the neighborhood. It turned out to be rather different. The neighborhood got rather large. He's still interesting, but instead of it being an exciting process, it's been more of a painful process to be part of because of not being able to really fully understand what this individual has to tell us.
Mm-hmm. We're a little bit past the midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and again, I should introduce our guest. We're speaking with Dr. James Chatters. He is an archaeologist. He has his own firm, which is a firm that specializes in forensic and archaeological consulting. It's called Applied Paleoscience. He's also an adjunct associate professor of research at Central Washington University. This is Washington State we're talking about. And is deputy coroner for Benton County, Washington. And is the author of this book, Ancient Encounters, Kennewick Man and the First Americans, published by Simon and Schuster. It's in the bookstores now if you want to read it. Questions are also certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Well, given now that some people have, there's been a lot of discussion about the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act and what it was intended to do and the argument that a find like Kennewick Man is old enough and unique enough so that it shouldn't apply. Are there any people in Washington, in Congress, for example, talking about revisiting the way that the act was written and try to make some changes?
Well, actually, there was Doc Hastings, who's the congressman for the district in which Kennewick Man was found, put forward an amendment to NAGPRA that thus far hasn't passed out of committee, but he's sort of biding his time. And what that simply does is it sort of eliminates the geographic claim and requires that a fairly strong degree of evidence be brought forward in order for claims to be made. It makes the standards the same as they are for anyone else, or closer to what they are for anyone who's non-Indian to make a claim on a skeleton. So I would be happier if it had some sort of time limit to it, but that would be a hard one to put through, I think. The last time cultures changed in America, in almost every place in the country, was around 2,000 years ago. So it was no more than 2,000 years ago. Some of them are as recent as, say, 700 years. And it's within that span of time that you could reasonably say that people are culturally affiliated with modern folks. Before that, it's a pretty tenuous claim to be making. But it can be hard to get support for doing that, I think. Mm-hmm.
Well, so where's Kennewick Man today?
Today, Kennewick Man is in Seattle at the Burke Museum. It's a Washington State Museum, sitting in the basement in a box and locked up. Mm. And biding his time, I guess. I'm actually working for I'm a principal scientist with a consulting firm in the Seattle area now, in addition to those other three things you were talking about. Uh-huh. And so Kennewick Man is just right across the lake from me.
Early on, I think that there was some concern about whether the remains were being properly stored so that they would be preserved. Are you still right. concerned about that, or you think that now they're doing what they should be doing to make sure that there's no further deterioration?
Well, I think they're making an effort. They're certainly making a strong show of it. But the Burke Museum had some problems last year. They had their air conditioning system caused the pipes to break, and they flooded the basement, which, of course, is where the skeleton is. So but not absolutely sure they're as secure as they might be in a place above ground somewhere. But I think they're doing a fairly reasonable job of taking care of it. One thing that was interesting that came up recently, actually right after, the day after the final hearing on the case, you might recall from the book that parts of both legs came up missing.
Yes.
And at large parts, I mean like bones a foot long, are missing from each leg. And I was one of the folks fingered for that, and so was the coroner. Well, the day after, and after 5 years of waiting, the day after the final hearing, suddenly the bones turned up.
They found them in the sheriff's office in Kennewick.
Well, they claimed to have found them in Kennewick. But they weren't in the place they claimed to have found them. They turned up a day when things were being moved from one place to another.
Hmm.
And they were never shown to the coroner until they were moved to the second place. So I'm not sure that they were ever there. The box that they turned up in was a box I'd sent to the coroner the day before Kennewick Man. And in it were the bones of other individuals found about a mile and a half away. So those bones should never have been in that box to start with.
Hmm.
So I'm a little... And there's another bag in there with them that doesn't fit any description I know of anything I sent with the skeleton proper. So it's a little bit unclear as to what happened there.
Hmm. Well, I suppose that this... You were somewhat relieved because the FBI was looking at this, and there was the possibility that there might have been some criminal charges pressed against you or anybody else because they thought that someone might have actually filched these bones that turned up missing.
Right. Well, I was able to turn that away a long time ago. Hmm. I took videotapes of the skeleton right before packing it in a box, and I had five witnesses to it being packed and carried away. But they were bothering the coroner for a while, and they even searched his lockup. And the FBI was unable to find the bones there, and that's supposedly where they turned up.
Hmm. So
that's another reason why things are a little suspicious. Either the FBI did a terrible job,
uh-huh.
which, who knows, or something strange is going on there.
But that's one that it sounds like it's not going to be resolved, probably. You won't really ever find out what happened. Huh?
No, the FBI says, oh, case closed.
Yeah.
They've got much more pressing things to deal with, like their reputation, than to bother with some old bones.
Yeah. Well, you talked about the fact that you think any day now that the judge is going to have a decision. If no matter what happens here, do you think that's likely it would be appealed and then could go on for who knows how long?
Well, if the government wins, remember this is a case between scientists and the U.S. government. It's not scientists suing Indians. It has to do with the interpretation of the law. And if the court finds in the government's favor, it'll be appealed by the scientists.
Hmm.
We know
mm-hmm.
that for certain. But I don't know whether the Bush administration's going to chase after it or not if they lose. They may or they may not. The Clinton administration would have, but we don't know the Bush administration well enough at this point to know whether they are going to or not.
Well, we have a caller to talk with. Why don't we do that
right.
In Savoy, line number one, right here. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Say, I've been listening to this, and we've kind of watched this from a distance, too. I guess the question that comes to my mind is what compelling reason do you offer to these Indian tribes to study the skeleton? I mean, is it absolutely essential that you have it? Or, you know, why don't you just work on a different project?
Well, we don't really have other skeletons to work on.
But that's
what
I'm
saying. This is one of the very few individuals who comes to us from a very distant past, from a people who may no longer be around.
Is the information so valuable that it cannot be found a different way?
The only way we can get a sense of what these people were like and what their lives were like is directly through their skeletons. Each human skeleton is a diary of the nature of a person's life, style of life, and individual experiences. Artifacts don't really tell you what those lives were like. Remains of houses, which we haven't found for that time period yet, but don't really tell you either. And the interest in this is actually not just among scientists, it's among many members of the public. I've heard from a lot of them by email and telephone over the years. It's also international. Everyone who comes to us, we've had people come in from Korea, Japan, most of the European countries, Australia, South America, because they're interested in this, just as they were interested in the Iceman from the Alps. This is one of the few messengers from a long distant time ago that can tell us a little more about the nature of the human story. That's why it's important. And what you're making a presumption of by the nature of your question and in part by the tone of your question is that the Indians somehow have a right to this. And that hasn't been established yet.
It doesn't sound to me like they really have to prove their point, because...
Actually, they do.
Well, you know...
Under the law, they do. But why would you presume they shouldn't have to prove their point? Isn't everyone else required to prove ownership of a body before they make a claim to it?
Well, not necessarily.
Yes, they are, actually. Yeah. In order to make a claim to recover a skeleton as a relative for burial, you have to establish very clearly that you're the relation of that person. You can't just take them by assertion.
Well, you know, I guess the point of my question is this court battle worth the information that you're after, and is the information so valuable that, you know, that it's going to make a profound change in these people's lives or even our lives, you know? And so whenever you fight so hard, but you, for something just, you know, just for curiosity's sake, that's not a compelling reason. It has to be something profound, and it has to be of such a nature that, you know, that it has an effect on society or these people, that, you know, that if you miss that chance, then there's going to be some consequences of it, like primarily negative consequences. And it just sounds like the reason that you're offering, you know, it tells me that this information's not absolutely essential that we know it. And why fight tooth and nail on this one particular case?
Well, we're not talking about one skeleton here. I mean, in discussing Kenneth McMahon, we're discussing one individual. But the case isn't really just about the one skeleton.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of focused on...
We're losing the fossils,
yeah,
the American human fossils, one after another, because we've got a movement, there's an ethnic identity movement out there that's attempting to establish eternity on the land.
Yeah.
And that's why we're hearing claims for the early skeletons. When I was in my earlier career, and we found human skeletons, and they were recent, we always called the local tribes in. We never had any issue. We didn't need a NAGPRA, in a sense, in the areas I've worked in, because we've always dealt as if such a law existed. And the tribes never really requested older skeletons. If they didn't know the cemetery they came from or weren't quite sure they were theirs, they were just curious about them. They weren't claiming them. It's a difference in politics right now that we're seeing. But what you're making an assumption is that this isn't of fundamental importance to us. And as far as we're concerned, it is of fundamental importance. This is the source of knowledge that we have, the field of knowledge that we've chosen to dedicate our lives to. And we're seeing that the window to that knowledge is being rapidly closed. And we don't have a problem with it being closed with the recent individuals where there's a relationship. No problem whatsoever. In fact, I've done a lot of repatriation work myself in support of Indian tribes' claims. But when we're into the long-distant past, this is my wife and my daughter's relative, too. My wife and daughter of Indian descent. It's theirs, too. It's the if it's an ancestor of American Indians, it's theirs, too. And we're not even sure that that's the case. We're dealing with Indians who were physically individuals in the earliest, among the earliest Americans, who are in all respects, in the genetics of their teeth and the morphology of their bodies and the characteristics of their faces and in the way they behaved, completely different from later populations. It isn't clear that these people have any descendants whatsoever. If that's the case, then if we deny if scientists aren't allowed to go in and investigate them and aren't allowed to learn from them what the nature of those people was from those bones, we lose the opportunity to give a place in history to a people who are extinct. And I don't think that's a moral thing to do.
We just have about 5 minutes left. I hope the caller will forgive me because I have another couple of other people and I want to try to get at least one more, if not both. We'll go next to Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I do agree with your expert, because I think it is of vital importance. I have a question, though, and it seems to me from watching public television, thank goodness for public television, there were programs about the trade that went on during the last ice age along the North Pole, and that the ice age, you know, really had moved quite far south. The ice of the Ice Age had moved quite far south. And I wonder if you have thought about the peoples who were part of that circular trade when the last Ice Age was here.
Well, you caught me there. I'm not sure. Are you speaking of the Little Ice Age?
About 10,000 years ago is my understanding, but, you know, since this is not a field I study, this is just things I've heard from, you know, reading and from listening to public television. But
there is one idea out there by Dennis Stanford of the Smithsonian and Bruce Bradley, who's a stone tool expert in Colorado, that one of the earliest stone technologies, anyway, the tool technologies in America, has strong similarities to what's called the Salutrian culture of Spain and southeastern France, or southwestern France. That's a very controversial idea. Some people really rail against it because they say, well, you're claiming Europeans came to America first. Well, whatever the ancestors of Americans are, of course, should be relatively immaterial to us. We should just want to know who they were. But other than that, I don't know about a trade that you're speaking of at that early time. I haven't heard about that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to Champagne here, line three. Hello.
Hi. I want to say I agree that things should be studied. However, do you feel that maybe the bones of the Kennewick individual should be reinterred? Because I think that's the main argument of the Indian rights people is not so much that it's their direct ancestor, but that just it's not respectful to display people. And if you could comment on the poor Ice Age guy that they found on Mount Blanc, I think, you know, you've been talking about the territorial right to these remains. Well, the French mm-hmm. and Italians are, you know, fighting it out over who gets the body from the Swiss, I guess. So,
well, the Italians and Austrians. It's found right on the Italian-Austrian border, and they've been arguing over who gets to control it in part.
Yeah, how do you feel about the reinterment? And I'll just leave it at that. Bye.
Okay.
Well, this is one thing I kind of delve into in the book a little bit, actually right at the end, that my feelings on this case are really quite mixed. On the one hand, just from a personal standpoint, I've gotten to know this individual rather intimately and have a good deal of sympathy for the way he lived his life and the amount of pain he went through during his life. And in part, I wouldn't mind seeing him at rest also. From a scientific standpoint, I have a very different perspective, and that is we need to learn as much as we can in order to understand the nature of our species and the history of our species. But I think there's a third position, too, and that's a moral position. And it's the one that kind of finally holds sway in the mixed emotions inside me. And that is that these do seem to be a people who aren't around anymore. And I think we respect them best by learning the most we can about them. So I end up coming down with maybe we better keep him and let future generations learn all they can from him so he can have his full place.
Mm. We're coming down to the point where we have a couple minutes left and probably not really enough time to discuss this point, but maybe I'll just ask real quick what it is now we're thinking about, how it is that humans came to the Americas. There was, I guess, for a long time, this idea that there was a point where things were frozen at the place where there was the closest contact between the old world and the new, where people literally could have walked
right.
here, and then from that point spread out. And now it seems that we're thinking that there perhaps were a number of waves of people moving in to the Americas and also from different places, that everybody didn't come that way.
Yes, the initial idea, the idea that's held sway for a long time at any rate, was that people came through the center of the Bering Land Bridge, which is a 1,000-mile wide landmass that connected Siberia and Alaska, and that they were big game hunters that lived on the tundra and went after elephants and bison and that sort of thing. It's beginning to look like that's not the case. In fact, it's becoming fairly clear that that wasn't the case, in part because the area they would have had to come through was an absolute wilderness, a barren landscape, but also because these earliest people that we're seeing don't resemble the central Siberians or the northeast Siberians that they're supposed to look like, but rather they resemble peaceful people from coastal Asia, peoples who now occupy coastal Asia and did for a good 20,000 years into the past. It's beginning to look like the migration came by way of the coastline, perhaps in multiple waves of immigration, not just one, and that the immigration through central Siberia was the last one to come in, and that it's the one that gives the distinct Siberian-like characteristics to American Indians, particularly in the Northwest and in the plains. There are also some suggestions, as I mentioned earlier, of folks coming across the North Atlantic around the rim of the ice, because it was a fairly productive zone with such things as flightless birds, seals, fish, many different kinds of sources of food along that ice margin. So it's possible that people may have come from Europe in part as well. So there may be a very complex picture of the peopling rather than that very simple single migration one.
Well, there we will have to stop because we're at the end of the time. Dr. Chatters, thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate
it. You're welcome. Great pleasure.
Our guest, James Chatters. And the book, if you'd like to read it, once again, is titled Ancient Encounters, Kennewick Man and the First Americans, and is published by Simon & Schuster and is in bookstores now. Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nickel, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at www.thriftynickel.com. The Thrifty Nickel, it's a good little paper. Later today on the Afternoon Magazine, a look at the human rights movement. Father Robert Drynan is Celeste Quinn's guest following 1 o'clock news. He's a priest, a lawyer, and a former member of Congress. His latest book is The Mobilization of Shame, A Worldview of Human Rights. You can hear that in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today.